Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing Bruce's Chili Chase. We're pleased to be joined by Ali Hill. Ali has a PhD in nutritional immunology from the University of Southampton and is currently the course leader for applied human nutrition at the School of Sport, Health and Social Sciences at Solent University and is a registered nutritionist. So hi Ali, thanks for joining us. So yeah, let's start, maybe from the beginning and just clarify some terms and get a feel for how you got to where you are today. So I think everybody's heard of the term nutritional. So what about immunology? What does immunology mean?
So immunology is basically a study of your response to illness. So the idea with nutritional immunology is that if you eat certain things, then perhaps they may make you less likely to have asthma or more likely to get better quicker.
Okay, so it's not necessarily about things that directly make you sick. It's about how food influences your susceptibility to other things. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's more about how you respond to things so that, you know, could you stop someone getting the cold, for example, or reduce how long you're ill for?
Right, okay. So what specifically were you looking at in your PhD and how did you go about tackling it?
So I was looking at omega-3s. So omega-3s you may have heard about before, but they are a special type of fat. And I was looking at fish oil in particular. And what I was actually interested in is whether when a mother eats fish oil in pregnancy, does that reduce the likelihood of her children getting allergies or getting asthma when they're older?
So like how do you attribute that single factor to a reduction in allergies? Are you able to keep all other variants the same, or do you have to account for that in your models when you're looking at things?
This is where it actually gets really difficult, because obviously in humans you can't really, unless you're going to grow people in the lab and just they're not going to leave the building at any point, you can't control everything about their diet. And that's why nutrition's really interesting, I think, and the research about it. You control what you can control and everything else you have to talk about as a limitation, really.
Right, so that led you on to your current position, which is in the applied human nutrition at the School of Sport, Health and Social Sciences. So tell us a little bit about what that school looks like. So what kind of people do you work with? What kind of questions do you look at? What exactly does applied human nutrition mean?
In terms of who I work with, there's quite a big variation. We've got a very strong sports department, so I work with a lot of physiologists and things like that, people who are basically trying to get to the same goal as I am, which is make an athlete really good and help them to win whatever it is that they're doing, really. But you can't do that just at one thing. We talked before about the fact that nutrition's actually really difficult to control, and there's so many other different factors about it. And that's one of the many reasons why you can't work with an athlete on your own. So you can't just look at nutrition. You also need to look at how the athlete's moving or how efficiently they're using oxygen and things like that. And anything that I change as a sports nutritionist will then have a run-on impact on whatever, you know, the way the athlete moves, or for example. And then that will affect some other parameter that's being measured in sports science too.
And how do you feel the science of kind of applied nutrition has grown over the years? What are some of the breakthroughs? What are some of the challenges you're still looking to solve?
I think applied nutrition is really interesting, because a lot of times when students graduate, they know the theory behind it, but then working with somebody is completely different. Because you might have somebody who says that they want to eat more fruit and veg, for example, but then they tell you that they don't like fruit and veg. So you've got that kind of challenge that you're working with. And so what we try and do is make sure that when students graduate, that they've had lots and lots of experience working with people, which just basically makes up for that kind of theory practice gap that you get quite often in health studies.
Right. And how do you find your students kind of deal with that? Is it a very unexpected, or is it a case of like that all the preparation doesn't actually account for what it's like when you're working with real people?
I think it's quite interesting if you look at, say, TV at the moment. So you get a lot of programs where like Secret Eaters, where people tell you what they eat, and then they get followed around by secret cameras and private detectives. And I think that generally gives the idea, or at least starts to kind of form that idea in people's heads about the fact that what people say they do and what they actually do are two very different things, which is where having a lot of experience with people can actually be really useful, because you know the kind of common things that people say and do, and also how you can help motivate them to change.
Just as a wider question, I think the field of nutrition, and especially with sports science, there seems to be a lot of misinformation on the internet, and a lot of kind of propagated ideas that maybe not that helpful. Some are quite good. How do you feel when you look at the wider thing? Is maybe one of the areas of science where a lot of people have an opinion, as opposed to something like quantum physics, where not many people have an opinion. Does that anger and annoy you, or do you see that as an educational challenge to overcome?
I think that's, for me, that's why nutrition's so interesting, because everybody eats, so everybody thinks that they're an expert in it. And it's not necessarily the science that's the issue. I mean, there are, obviously, you're always going to get people who disagree in science, and it's about trying to find out what the answer is, and that's obviously really difficult to do in experiments. But it's more that you get a lot of anecdotal evidence, which people then take for gospel. So because it's worked for their friend down the pub, then it must be something that's scientifically valid. And that's really where the issue is, I think, in nutrition.
I think it's time we probably go into your story now. Before we do our story, we ask our guests to choose a Batman actor who they want to represent their Batman. Have you chosen somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be Idris Elba.
Idris Elba, that's a very good choice. Are you a long-time Idris Elba fan? What do you think he would bring to the role?
I think he's really good at that kind of confliction that Batman's got. So he's obviously got this daytime persona, and then his nightlife as well. And they're obviously two completely different things. He's had quite a troubled upbringing as well. And I just think that that's the kind of thing that Idris Elba would be really good at just showing.
Yeah, I think he'd be a superb Bruce Wayne as well. He's very suave when he wants to be, so I think he'd really be able to pull that off. A young Bruce Wayne, before donning the mantle of the Bat, travels the world to improve his skills in both the mental and the physical to prepare for the currently amorphous destiny he knows lies ahead. Embedded within a remote tribe in Peru, Bruce must pull his weight when it comes to hunting, foraging, and work within the community. Astounded by the physical endurance of some of the tribe, who can keep working when Bruce can barely move through exertion, he wonders how he can keep up. So, Ali, let's talk about some of the specifics of your work then, and how you may be able to help. So what might be going on here?
Well, there's a number of different things that could be happening. The thing about sports nutrition is that supplements only really work if everything else is working as well. So it's only if you've got your energy balance right, so what you're eating compared to what you're expending, if you've got your macronutrients right, so your carbohydrates, proteins and fats, the timing that you take them is also really important. So it's only when all of these things come together that you can actually get a supplement that may benefit him even further and get him to push himself further than he was able to do so without it.
Okay, so I think that's a really important point, and I think that's something I think would be very beneficial to be wider known. Obviously, the supplement industry is huge, and I think a lot of people have a misconception that supplements will do the heavy lifting for them with sports science and with general health and fitness. So you're saying that, like, everything else kind of has to be in place, and then you'll be able to get the benefits from those supplements. So what are those things? Let's dig into those. So we were talking about nutrition, general nutrition, sleep. What else has to be going on?
Your hydration has to be right as well. So obviously, if you're in a hot country, it's kind of like, if you don't drink properly, it's sort of a little bit like that feeling you get when you're hungover and you're dehydrated and your brain doesn't work. I mean, that's obviously an extreme example, but you do get the same kind of thing generally if your hydration's just not quite right.
Okay, so these people that he's living with, obviously they're very familiar with their environment. So we've talked about hydration, and somewhere hot and humid like Peru, hydration is going to be very important. So that's going to be a big factor as to why you can't keep up. They've got their nutrition down. Obviously they're sleeping okay, so that's something else he might not be used to. But what supplements might they be using that maybe Bruce isn't used to, that is going to give them the extra edge when it comes to endurance?
There's a number of different things that they could be using, but something that I'm really interested in the moment is actually capsaicin, and that comes from chilies, and that's really what makes it hot. And the idea here is that the hotter the chili, the more capsaicin it has. Now, capsaicin is actually used as a cream in conditions like osteoarthritis, so you can put it on your skin and it reduces the pain that you feel. And what I'm interested in is finding out is if you eat chilies, will that have the same effect as if you put them in on as a cream?
Okay, so these people might be eating a lot of chilies, and that might be the thing that's be giving them the edge. But how do you go about looking at that in the lab environment, in a science environment? What do you do to try and prove or disprove that hypothesis?
This is where it gets a little bit complicated. So first thing I need to do is make sure that people don't take any chili in their diet. So I can compare giving them some chili compared to not giving them, or giving them a placebo, but I'm only gonna notice a difference if they're not eating chili to begin with. Now again, this also creates a bit of a problem, because the type of people that I'm interested in, I need to make sure that they usually do eat chili, because otherwise they're gonna get that kind of gut rot that you get after you've had a hot curry if you're not used to it. And then in terms of the tests that I do, I try and make sure that they're related to the sport. So for example, with cyclists, I get them on a cycle, on a bike, and cycling for as long as they could do perhaps, and then seeing if the time that they can cycle for is longer when they've had chili compared to when they've had the placebo. It's obviously really difficult in sports to try and replicate exactly certain sports. So I can't test swimmers, for example, because I can't get a swimming pool in my lab. But I could do cycling and I could do running, and those kind of sports are the ones that I tend to focus on.
Okay, and how has the work been going so far? Does things look promising, or?
It's hard to say at the moment, to be honest. I'm still recruiting, so I've got a very small sample size, but I'm still looking for people at the moment. So if anybody is a cyclist or triathlete in the Southampton area and would like to get involved in it, then please get in touch. I can give you some more details on it.
Absolutely. So that an interesting point as well. Could we talk a little bit about the importance of sample size and how that might skew potential results?
Yeah, sample size is really important. If you have a small sample, then you can't say that what this group experiences is going to be the same as everybody experiences. So as an example, if you went to a girls' school and you said that you've got a sample of 3 girls, for example, or even one girls' school compared to the whole range of schools in the UK, you're going to assume if your sample size is quite small that all children who go to school are girls, whereas that's not the case. And it's the same as if you have a massive sample size. So what that basically means there is that you've used more people to experiment on than you need to. So again, that's arguably not very ethical either.
Okay, so it's not just having too small, it can also be too large is a problem. So we've talked about chilies. Are there any other kind of natural supplements and things that you've found to be useful in your sports science that are not pills or anything like that, things that people can find in supermarkets or in their homes?
There's loads of different things that you can have, and actually that's an interesting point, because if it's a supplement, it doesn't need to be approved by the Department of Health, which means that when the manufacturers make it, they don't actually need to prove that it has any benefit. And that's something that you really need to be aware of when you're choosing a supplement.
I didn't know that. So I could make any kind of sugar pill with added grass and say this does X, and there's no recourse to that.
No, you don't need to prove it. It's quite a complex area, a bit of a shame really. It doesn't count as a food, so that's where you kind of, it's a bit of a grey area really.
Okay, so I mean let's go back towards other things that people might be able to use that they have ready access to that are not $29.95 a month for X bottle of pills. What can people find in a supermarket that might be able to help with their performance?
So like I said before, the first thing you need to do is make sure that your nutrients are all right and all good. So protein supplements can work, but there's nothing in them that you can't get from your diet. It's more that they're a bit more convenient, perhaps. So after you exercise, you've got this hour window in which what you want to get protein and carbohydrates in to replenish your muscles. And that's where protein shakes and stuff can be quite helpful, but you don't really need them. And there's nothing in them that a milkshake won't do, for example. Other things that you might want to use are beetroot juice. Depending on how long Batman is fighting crimes for, or any of your other listeners, we think that they can be useful for about 4 to 30 minutes, any kind of events in that. And what they do is they contain nitrates, which get converted to nitric oxide in your body. And this is a vasodilator, which means that it actually expands your blood vessels, which means that you increase your blood flow and there's more oxygen and nutrients that actually get to your body, which basically increases your efficiency. Caffeine's really interesting because a lot of people, we know that hydration is important, and a lot of people think that caffeine dehydrates you, and it can do, but if you're used to it and if you're only having a small amount, then it tends not to. Where it gets a bit more interesting is that it can make you feel less fatigue and feel less pain, and the reason for that is that it stimulates your central nervous system and it increases your endorphins. So if you have a little bit of caffeine, like a cup of coffee or something before you race, then it can actually help you and mean that you perform better.
So talking about the supplement industry and things like that, so we've learned that amazing fact that there's not really any kind of regulation as to proving the efficacy of these things. But are there any other things that maybe people who are more elite at level who are really going to be able to take advantage of these supplements need to keep in mind with the providers or the supplements that they buy?
One of the big things that people need to consider at the elite level is contamination. So it could be that there's something in the supplement that's not on the label. And there was a study done in 2004 that tested 634 supplements, and they found that 15% of them had something, a banned substance, in them that wasn't on the label. And this is obviously an issue if you're an elite athlete.
So what does a banned substance mean?
So the World Anti-Doping Association, WADA, has a list of supplements that can unfairly advantage people. So you probably heard about Chris Froome and the aspirin inhaler, for example. It's allowed at a certain level, but then once you go over it, it becomes an issue.
Okay, so these aren't necessarily illegal substances. These are things that are banned by sports bodies, and they may not be put on a label because it would infringe how they sell to. Or what rationale did people, or if anything, did people come up with for why these weren't listed?
I don't know if they're necessarily deliberately not listed. So it could be that it's made in the same factory or made on the same equipment as a banned substance, which is why it just ends up contaminating it, but possibly not deliberately.
Right, so if Batman gets his nutrition and his sleep and starts eating the chili-infused local cuisine of the tribe, hopefully he can keep his endurance up and pull his weight as part of the team. So thanks very much, Ali, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And if you'd like to find out more about Ali and her work, you can find her on Twitter at Dr. Ali Hill. That link will be in the description. If you'd like to find out more about Ali's course and maybe even come and volunteer, that's the Applied Human Nutrition, and the link of that will also be in the description. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.